This is the Nichols-Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December the 15th, 2014. This podcast is presented by Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. It is intended for your personal non-commercial use, and any other use of this podcast without the express written consent of the Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated and your state society of CPAs is prohibited. The podcast is copyright 2014 by Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to talk this week about what's happened in the past week with regard to taxes. And things have been relatively quiet on the tax front because everybody's watching what's happening in Washington and seeing if we're going to actually get the extender bill and the ABLE account bill in play. They were pretty much set where we were a week ago. There was some talk during the week of adding and making three charitable provisions permanent. That particular attempt to get permanent addition for three charitable provisions ended up not going anywhere. It did not get finished. There was the threat of a presidential veto eventually, and there was simply the problem about whether there was time to get it done in any event. So that program got pushed forward. So we are again sitting with the two bills we talked about last week. Again, it would appear if we're going to get tax bills before the end of the year, these are the ones we're going to get. The Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had indicated that he plans to bring these up for a vote. It appears if they come up for a vote before they leave that the Congress will pass these. But, of course, our problem with Congress is always that it's not over till it's over, and we have to make sure that these actually get passed and signed into law. If that happens, we are going to have a bill, though probably with less than 2 weeks to use for actual tax planning. So you need to keep your eyes open over the next week and keep your eyes on Washington for what happens to the two bills we discussed. Now, with that, we are going to talk about a couple of things that are going on this week. First, let's talk about the issues that were with the ABLE bill. The ABLE bill we discussed last week, there are a few additional provisions I wanted to discuss this week. These are provisions aside from the ABLE account, but this is going to allow us to set up and handle certain things. So some of these provisions are things that Congress put into the law because Congress is looking to raise some money, and some of them are simply corrections to other provisions that have been in the law before or adding new programs. So let's discuss what's in the ABLE bill in addition to the ABLE account we discussed last week. First, Act Section 105 would provide a modification to the rules for 529 education savings plans. It would allow an account contributor or designated beneficiary to direct investments twice per year. Currently, the law prohibits the direction of investments, and it would be general direction of investment that would be allowed to be done twice per year. But the IRS had indicated that you could provide general investment direction and change that general direction once per year, that would not violate the rule in the law. Congress has now gone back, changed the law. They will provide an explicit twice per year rule that will be involved. Again, this requires us to actually pass the bill, and it would be effective for items that are, would be effective for, I should say, 529 plan investments beginning next year. As well, Section 206 of the Act would set up a new certification program for professional employer organizations. This is meant to solve a problem that we ran into in cases like the Citywide Transit case, where an employer had a payroll service come in and handle their payroll. But it turns out the payroll service was not actually paying the IRS. In the case of Citywide Transit, in fact, the person was running a rather involved embezzlement scheme, giving Citywide Transit one set of 941s and filing a different set with the IRS to show no taxes had to be paid. He was actually using, in those days, the advanced earned income credit to basically cover the tax payments, and then he would turn around and pocket the money. Well, it turns out when the advanced earned income credit went away, that kind of clobbered that problem. We couldn't have anything of that sort. So everything fell apart, and eventually it's discovered, of course, that Citywide Transit owes a bunch of money. Well, the concept here would be if you had a certified PEO, the responsibility for the payroll taxes would move to the PEO from the employer. So if an employer used a certified PEO, then basically they could be insulated from those sorts of problems. The program provides, the IRS will set up a certified PEO program for the first tax year beginning 12 months after the date of enactment of the bill. So assuming the bill is passed in the next week and assuming the president signs it before the end of the year, we would be able to see these programs beginning not in 15, but 16 would be the first year we would have certified PEO programs. The PEO would pay in a $1,000 fee to the IRS, would have to meet certain compliance requirements that they, you know, kept up to date, were filing timely, had filed their clients' returns timely, etc., deposited the payroll taxes timely, all those rules, would have to post a bond, and would have to submit an annual audited financial statement to the IRS. The IRS would then publish and grant certification to these organizations, and that would allow employers to understand that if they use those organizations, they would be safe from these sort of problems that we saw in the citywide transit case. This is probably a positive development, especially because of the issues that we ran into with payroll services, that even if they weren't of the sort that we talked about in citywide transit, where it was strict embezzlement, there were still services that got in financial trouble, and unfortunately, at times, that financial trouble could have caused payroll taxes to go undeposited. This will protect employers from that standpoint. Next in line, Section 207 of the Act would exempt from the personal holding company income definition for corporations dividends from controlled foreign corporation subsidiaries, CFC subsidiaries. That rule would be effective for tax years ending on or after the date of enactment. So if you have that situation, obviously this would be a useful change. If you don't have, which probably many of you don't, then it's probably something that's not relevant to you. But again, if you do, significant issue that you have in play. Section 208 of the Act is where we start raising some revenue. What we're going to end up doing is inflation adjust various penalties in the Internal Revenue Code that are dollar denominated. For instance, the most significant one that we're going to find in there are the penalties for late filing a partnership or S corporation tax return. That $195 per month would then become inflation adjusted. The inflation adjustment would take effect for tax returns required to be filed after December 31st, 2014, which means effectively the 2014 returns would be the first one to face the higher penalties. Finally, Section 209 of the Act would raise the maximum amount of continuous levy by the IRS against a Medicare provider to 30% from the current 15%. So it would double the amount that could be taken from a doctor's Medicare or any other sort of healthcare provider's Medicare payments to 30% of those payments. It would be effective 180 days from the date of enactment. Again, these are all additional changes that are in the ABLE Act. Remember, that act passed overwhelmingly in the House. It is assumed, but we don't want to take it for granted at this point, but it's assumed that it will pass the Senate this week. If that happens, these provisions are something we're going to have to be ready to work with in the law. Other things that happened this week, wasn't a whole lot going on. Notice 2014-79, we got the new mileage rates for next year. The mileage rate for next year for general standard business rate will be 57.5 cents a mile. The charitable rate will be 14 cents per mile. Medical and moving expenses will be 23 cents per mile. And if you're using the standard mileage rate in 2014 or 2015, the depreciation component of that number will be 24 cents per mile. Again, these are the new numbers for mileage, so you need to update those for your clients for payroll purposes, maybe even for your own internal payroll department. You need to understand and get those numbers changed for this level. Next up is a Fifth Circuit case. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed a tax court decision this week in the case of Mingo versus Commissioner. Now, this is 2014 TNT 23815, issued on December the 9th. CCH and RA will likely discuss it this week, so you'll see CCH and RA references to the Fifth Circuit decision likely published in the coming week. They usually publish slightly after tax analysts. It was affirming Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2013-149. The issue in this case, there were hot assets in the question here, it really is a continuation of some of the issues we've seen with consulting partners of the various international accounting firms and the transactions when those accounting firms either spun out or sold off their consulting divisions. This one involved the sale of PricewaterhouseCoopers consulting division to IBM and one particular partner in this case. In the case of Mingo, she basically received a note from IBM in exchange for her partnership interest. What PricewaterhouseCoopers did was they spun the consulting off to a new partnership. PricewaterhouseCoopers itself maintained an interest in that partnership for a very short time. And the consulting partners essentially exchanged their PricewaterhouseCoopers shares for the PwC consulting shares. Then IBM bought all of the PwC consulting shares, some from PricewaterhouseCoopers and some from the various partners. In this case, she received a note from IBM. That note could be exchanged for IBM stock down the line. In 2002, she reported the entire thing as an installment sale. She reported no gain. That was true even though she had a significant amount, in this case, we talked about ordinary income, of over $100,000 of receivables that were hot assets in her share. Now, she admitted at trial eventually they gave up on the idea they weren't hard assets. But the interesting problem was the IRS exam did not examine the 2002 return. They examined 2003. And by the time they determined that this issue existed, the 2002 return was closed for assessment. The IRS argued, A, that that ordinary gain, that hot asset amount, was not eligible for the installment sale treatment, which the tax court sustained. The tax court said it was like payments for services. And they said, going back and citing the case of Sorensen versus Commissioner from 1954, they held that when you have this sort of asset, we have a hot asset receivables in a service partnership, if you trigger that when you sell your partnership interest on an installment basis to a third party, that whole gain has to be recognized instantly. Well, the next problem was 2002 was closed for assessment by the IRS. And obviously, the problem was that ordinary gain should have been reported in 2002. But the IRS argued that their use of the installment basis was a method of accounting. Being a method of accounting, they could make a 41A adjustment by forcing her onto a new method in 2003, and therefore force her to pick that up in 2003 as ordinary income. She argued, no, it wasn't a method of accounting. She, of course, argued it was simply an error. The tax court agreed with the IRS. They said it's clear when she reported on the installment basis, she wasn't saying she had to pay tax on the gain. She just claimed she had to pay tax on the gain until she finally got cash for the transaction or, as it turned out in her case, exchanged it for IBM stock. The tax court said, that means you agreed with the timing. Now, she obviously didn't agree with the type of income it would be, but the court felt that was a method of accounting. And what the IRS had done was shown that it misstated income. They have broad authority in that realm. So the court found that it was perfectly within reason for her to go ahead and have to pick it up in 2003. The Fifth Circuit this week heard the appeal of this case. The Fifth Circuit sustained the tax court analysis on all issues. Next up, the Supreme Court denied certiorari in the case of the estate of Foster versus Commissioner. That basically, therefore, sustains the Ninth Circuit's decision in that case. This case involved the question of a liability involved for a trust. In this case, an estate of a deceased. In this case, a woman had basically, survived her husband. Her husband had been an owner, one of the owners of a closely held company that had sold its shares to an ESOP. The company ran into the financial troubles, and the ESOP effectively sued to claim that the husband, or now a decedent, shall we say, at that point, by the time the suit got filed, had violated his fiduciary duty to the ESOP. Because of that, the trustee of the marital trust, which is where the assets of his went to, ended up freezing the assets there. The trustee of the marital trust was also a trustee of the ESOP, so there's lots of things flying around here. Now, they froze the assets. She couldn't take withdrawal until this was settled. She dies before everything's settled. The estate claimed two alternative reasons to reduce the value of the marital trust. First, they claimed that they should get a discount because it was not marketable. There was a marketability problem at that point, and the fact she couldn't withdraw meant there was a liquidity problem, and they should be able to get a discount for that. The Ninth Circuit disagreed. The Ninth Circuit, sustaining the trial court, held that, in fact, a buyer would not have been liable for that particular lawsuit against the estate. Rather, the buyer could have bought all the assets from the trust, and the trust, therefore, would have sat on cash. Now, true, the decedent still couldn't get the cash out of that, but that's okay, but a buyer of the asset would not have reduced it because they would not have become a party to the lawsuit. The other side of the equation became, then the estate said, well, then we should be able to get a liability for a potential liability on this lawsuit. And the court there said, well, here's the problem you've got in this case. A liability is only deductible for estate tax purposes if it can be established with reasonable certainty. And because of the wild difference in views among the various experts that testified in the case, the court found that, in essence, there was no good way to figure out what liability, if any, was really going to be due in this case when the decedent passed away. Therefore, because liability could not be established with reasonable certainty, no deduction was allowed for a liability. Therefore, the entire value of the, and in this case, apparently Q-tip trust, had to end up in her estate with no adjustment based on this lawsuit. Finally, the IRS finalized this week the FACTA regulations for individual reporting, Treasury Decision 9706. It basically adopted the original proposed regulations with a few minor changes here. As you may recall, under the FACTA rules, individuals have to file a report with their individual returns separate and apart from the FBAR filing that goes in at June 30th to the Treasury Department that describes these assets. The assets that have to be reported is any account, foreign account that has a foreign financial account, any stock or security not held in a brokerage account, basically that is a U.S. brokerage, so it's not inside an account, and any other instruments where there is a foreign counterparty or where there is an issuer that is a foreign party. And you must report the maximum value of the asset. This particular reporting job was came up with this issue on the factor reporting under 6038D. Now, the IRS made some minor modifications. They did add a special rule for dual resident taxpayers. If a taxpayer is a resident of the U.S. and another country, there's a treaty between the two, and under the terms of the treaty, the taxpayer elects to be treated as a resident of the other country. As long as they file the proper paperwork with the IRS to show they've made that election, and they file the proper form, that form that goes with that will be a form 8833, that will be in this with the 1040-NR, indicating they're claiming a treaty benefit, they will not be required to file this factor report. Other things that happened, there was a number of other changes that people requested. The IRS basically, for the most of the preamble, explained all the reasons why they weren't changing anything in here. One other change they did make, though, that was somewhat useful, is they did clarify that if you have services and you receive this foreign security in exchange for your services, but you're not vested in it yet, and you've not made an A3B election, you don't report the value of that asset. If you make an A3B election, you do report the value of the asset. You don't wait for the restrictions to lapse. So basically, if you've included an income because the restrictions have lapsed, or because you made the A3B election, you must report it. If the restrictions are still in place, they have not yet lapsed, you've made no A3B election, those assets will not need to be reported. The IRS also requested, interestingly enough, comments on how under FACTA to handle Bitcoin and other virtual currencies. That is a troublesome issue for the IRS because Bitcoin, by its very nature, very difficult to determine where it is in terms of, we're talking about physical locations or countries. It's an interesting problem for this reporting, and the service is asking about how this should be handled. We'll have to see what the IRS's eventual outcome is on this. One concern may be that eventually their idea may be that we'll just treat all Bitcoin as a foreign asset because essentially we can't really say for sure it's a U.S. asset. But we'll take a look, see what it is. For the moment, they've not released that. The IRS also did not release at this point regulations on reporting by entities other than individuals under the FACTA rules. Those regs are still to come later. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 15th, 2014. Be sure to check in next week when maybe we'll know if we have a new law, and also see what other developments we have here coming up towards the end of 2014.